A week after Easter, Pope John Paul II will be beatified. As part of an ongoing series, we are looking at some personal reminiscences of the late pontiff. Kishore Jayabalan worked for both the Office of the Permanent Observer to the Holy See at the United Nations and the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace here in Rome. But his first encounter with Pope John Paul II was during the Easter Vigil of 1996, when he was baptized by the Pope. He spoke with Charles Collins about his experiences.
That was 15 years ago, in 1996, April 6, 1996, to be exact. During the Easter Vigil Mass in St. Peter's Basilica, myself, along with 9 other adults from various parts of the world, I was the only one coming from the United States or even the Western Hemisphere, for that matter. The rest were from Italy, France, and East Asia were the others who were welcomed into the church at the same time I was by John Paul II.
How did this come about? How were you chosen for this honor?
I'm still not exactly sure how I was chosen, besides, you know, the fact that I had people looking out for me in all kinds of places here on Earth and I think also upstairs. The normal process for any catechumen is to go through the RCIA program, the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults program, at a parish. And I started that in Arlington, Virginia, before I went to graduate school in Toronto at the University of Toronto. So I went through the whole process once again there. And I went to study political philosophy, of all things. And during a seminar on Nietzsche, I met my my future godfather, who happened to be a member of Opus Dei. And every Holy Week in Rome, there is something called Univ, which, you know, I'm sure most of your Roman listeners and anybody who's familiar with Holy Week in Rome will recognize. There are, you know, thousands of university students that come for a week of spiritual formation on pilgrimage and all kinds of other activities. So what my future godfather said is, why don't we go to Rome for Univ? And while we're there, why don't we look into getting you baptized by the Holy Father? And of course, I thought he was making all of this up. I didn't take it seriously at all. I looked for every excuse in the book not to come to Rome. You know, money, time, studies, etc. But I have to give him credit. He was very persistent, and I came to my senses and said, "Of course, I'd like to go." It turned out it was actually more complicated than that getting over here. I found out much later that the Vatican tends to look for one or two people from each country maximum. And so they wouldn't want to have, let's say, more than two men coming from the United States. And I'd heard that another American had already been chosen to come and then at the last minute kind of dropped out. And all these kind of changes were taking place, which I didn't know anything about until much later. But thankfully, all worked out in the end. I came for Univ. I think I arrived Palm Sunday morning. So I was here for all of Holy Week. And of course, all the events led up to Easter, and it was quite a memorable occasion, as you can imagine. Everything started with a rehearsal on Saturday morning, where the master of ceremonies told us in a very quick Roman fashion, in Italian. You know, none of us were Italians. Well, there was one Italian there, but the rest of us didn't know any Italian. So the instructions we received as to what we were supposed to do during the Mass kind of went, you know, in one ear and out the other very quickly. But we all made it through. We gathered together in front of Michelangelo's Pietà, maybe 2 hours before the Mass, which gave us the opportunity to see all the cardinals and bishops coming in to be vested before Mass, which was quite an honor, of course. And, you know, not being a Catholic at the time, you know, I didn't know a lot of who these people were. But I remember my godfather pointing out Cardinal Ratzinger, pointing out Cardinal Sodano, pointing out all of these quite important people, figures in the church, and how amazing it was to watch them come in one by one to get to prepare for Mass. And in this very exclusive area in front of the Pietà, you know, off to the side in St. Peter's Basilica. And then we went outside into the portico to have the Easter candle lit, and we proceeded in just in front of the Holy Father. And everyone else, all the bishops and cardinals came in before us. And as we proceeded into St. Peter's Basilica, it was all dark, of course. And then they you know, you stop and you pause, and I think it's for the Lumen Gentium when the lights of the basilica come in on the second repetition. And it's quite a moment, because you're realizing all these people are there. Of course, they're there for the Holy Father primarily. They're all looking back, but you're right in front of him. And you come to the baldacchino in front of the tomb of St. Peter, and you're seated in the front row in front of all the cardinals and the diplomats and the dignitaries. So it's you looking at the Holy Father above the tomb of St. Peter. And the Mass proceeds from there. Like I said, the sacraments are the most important part because you're welcomed into the church. We were baptized over the lap of the Holy Father. I remember this very clearly. And as he poured the water over his head, over our heads, we were baptized in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And our Christian names were read. And my Christian name is Augustine. So I remember him baptizing me, Augustine, in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And we also received our confirmation and our first communion, and we presented the gifts during the offertory as well, and had a chance to meet the Holy Father briefly after Mass. I think after Holy Week and Lent, the Holy Father was quite tired, but he still managed to greet us all and wished us a Buona Pasqua, and of course it was quite a thrill.
Did he say anything particular to you, ask any questions? Or?
No, he said Happy Easter in English and Buona Pasqua. He obviously realized I spoke English. And I don't remember chatting with him very much at the time. I might have been a little bit starstruck and dazed by the whole occasion. But he was tired. It was quite obvious that he was he had a long Triduum and Holy Week and Lent. And so, part of it is your tongue is tied when you meet the Holy Father. What are you supposed to say to John Paul II the first time you meet him, especially after receiving the sacraments of Christian initiation? I mean, you're on cloud nine. You don't really know what to say. So it's probably better to keep it short and sweet.
Did he have any interactions with the other people being baptized that you remember?
I recall during the baptisms, I was the second of the 10 to be baptized. A Chinese gentleman named Pietro was before me, and I was the second. And then there were a number of East Asians following. And towards the end, some of the I think there were Vietnamese and some Koreans, and they were dressed in their traditional garb. And I remember looking at the Holy Father towards the end of the 9 or 10 who were being received into the church, and I saw him weeping. And that was quite a moving occasion because there must have been some realization that this is the future of the church. And these people who suffered so much persecution in terms of war, persecution against the church, and these people were coming and being received into the church. Some of them were as families as well. Let's say a husband, a wife, and a child, all being baptized at the same time. And for somebody like John Paul II, who knew his share of suffering as a Pole, and as a bishop, suffering under the Nazis and the communists, to see other people from so far away but joining the same church and receiving the same call as all of us, not only the universality of the church but also the realization of the bloody history of the 20th century and what the totalitarian regimes tried to do to the church but never could do, which was namely to destroy it, to see that being defeated one by one was a very emotional moment, and I'm sure John Paul II recalled lots of baptisms he had performed in the past, let's say in Poland and in Rome.
Now, this encounter, the impressive encounter with the Holy Father, was not the end of your experience with the Pope, with the Holy See, because shortly thereafter, you actually started working for the Vatican, didn't you?
That's right. Little did I know that the baptism was just the beginning in more ways than one. I returned to my graduate studies after being received into the Catholic Church. And while I was at the University of Toronto, I was very fortunate to be able to serve as a student campus minister at the Newman Center on campus. And that was then headed by Father Tom Ruzicka, who is now the head of Salt and Light Television in Canada. And if anybody knows Father Ruzicka, they know he's a very energetic, outgoing, entrepreneurial type of priest. And he immediately snatched me up. I was fresh off the airplane, and he basically had me signed up to be a campus minister, which provided me with a lot of opportunity to learn about living in a community and serving the church on a campus and getting to know other students who were going through RCIA following me. But he arranged for then Archbishop Renato Martino who was the permanent observer of the Holy See to the United Nations in New York, to come and give a talk at the Newman Center in Toronto about the work of the Holy See at the UN. And I remember following the talk, there was quite a bit of discussion between Archbishop Martino and Father Ruziga about starting an internship program at the UN. And little did I know that I had really no interest in going there. I was kind of down on New York City, being a Midwesterner, and I never thought I would actually live there. And I really didn't have any desire to work at the United Nations. But 6 months later, Father Ruziga said, you know, we think you would be the best person to be our first Newman Center intern at the Holy See Mission in New York. And, you know, I thought about it. I thought about my graduate studies, and it seemed like a good time and a good opportunity to go to New York. And once I was there, I absolutely loved it. Not only the experience of living in New York City, but working at the United Nations and meeting people literally from every country. And you also get the opportunity to serve the church. And that was my first experience with the Holy See in its diplomatic role. And so I got to meet a lot of excellent priests who not only served the church, but served the international community in terms of defending human dignity and doing all kinds of service for the international community in terms of defending the innocent, the vulnerable, not looking out so much for the interests of the Holy See as a state, but really performing the voice, being a voice of moral conscience, as John Paul II said in his 1995 address to the UN. And I did that for 2 years. I wasn't sure what I was going to be doing after that. I think I looked a little bit for work in New York. And not too long after that, Archbishop Martino and then Bishop Diarmid Martin, who used to come to New York quite often for UN meetings, especially in the social and economic affairs, decided that they needed to find a replacement, an English-speaking replacement who understood the United Nations, to come work in Rome at the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. And I was offered that position after 2 years in New York, and I came here in September of 1999 to serve as the more or less the analyst for disarmament and environmental issues, as well as a desk officer for English-speaking countries. And so I served there at the Council for Justice and Peace for 5 years, all under John Paul II, of course. And the president of the Pontifical Council at the time was Cardinal François Xavier Nguyen Van Thuan, the Vietnamese then archbishop who became a cardinal while I was at the council, and whose cause for beatification has now been opened. And in a few weeks, I'll actually be accompanying Father Robert Sirico, the president of the Acton Institute, to the Vicariato of Rome to provide some testimony on the cause of Cardinal Van Thuan. So that's another great fruit that's come from this time here.
Now, during this time that you worked for the Holy See, of course, as you put it, these lowly desk officers and the pontifical councils don't have daily encounters with the Holy Father. But did you have any kind of interaction? Did you see Pope John Paul II while you were working in Rome?
I saw Pope John Paul II quite a few occasions while I was at the Council for Justice and Peace. We had a few larger audiences during plenary assemblies, and there were a few other occasions. I remember when Father Ruziga and the Canadian delegation for World Youth Day 2002 in Toronto came, and at the Palm Sunday service the preceding year in 2001, there's the exchange of the World Youth Day cross. And I was lucky to be able to greet the Holy Father once again with that delegation. But probably my most memorable meeting with John Paul II after working, or while I was working at the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, was during a meeting that the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue had organized with some theologians from Iran. And I was asked to give a presentation at this meeting on the Catholic understanding of justice. And this was in commemoration of John the 23rd's Pacem in Terris, with its focus on justice, charity, and liberty and peace. And I recall we had a small audience with the Holy Father, the Iranian theologians, and our delegation from the Council for Interreligious Dialogue. And I remember the Holy Father, this was in 2004, I believe. I remember the Holy Father, who was then again, you know, quite elderly quite visibly suffering, that he still managed to have a very good sense of humor. After meeting many of the Iranian theologians, he came across a Lebanese priest and he said, "You are a Christian," you know, as if to say, "I recognize the color," you know, and the sense of humor was still very palpable. And we also, you know, I had a chance to greet the Holy Father on that occasion, as well as during the Exchange of the World Youth Day Cross. And I, like I said, I'd seen him several times in much larger groups, but I'll never forget April 2005, and being around St. Peter's Square. Like everyone else, you know, hearing that the Holy Father was at, you know, living through his last days, and being in the square and in the square also for his funeral was something I'll never forget. Not only because I had a personal connection with him, but like everyone else there, he was our spiritual father. You know, we were all orphans once he left the stage, certainly until Pope Benedict's election. And I think it struck everyone that that we had lost not only, you know, a great man, but a father in a lot of ways.
He baptized you. You soon thereafter worked for him, for the man. What is the lasting impact of Pope John Paul II on your life?
It's hard to say that there is a lasting impact in a final sense, and because I'm growing every day. You know, I fall quite often, and I have to get up and try again. And I'll never forget what the prelate of Opus Dei told me just before my baptism, when I had a chance to meet him. He said, "Look, you're getting a clean slate, right, with the baptism. You're having a brand new, sparkling soul that's coming out of this. Keep it clean with regular confession." And I think any recourse to the sacraments, in a way, is going back to that first moment, that first encounter with John Paul II. Receiving the sacraments of Christian initiation is just the beginning of your Christian life, of course. And it's going to be a struggle. It's not going to be easy. I don't think anybody who enters the Catholic Church as an adult would deny that it's not something that's not going to be a cakewalk. Your life is not going to just all of a sudden, you know, zoom towards sainthood from there. You're going to have to fight to maintain the graces that you received. And I also think that in the role I have now, working for the Acton Institute, John Paul II's great defense of human freedom. We're only now, I think, starting to understand what that means after the fall of communism, and when we see other threats to human freedom coming from the West, let's say with the kind of bioethical realm, coming from, let's say, you know, extreme Islamism and the threats that they pose to religious liberty as well as human freedom at large. When you look at the way the world economy is proceeding, when you have institutions that are getting larger and larger and larger, what does that mean for human freedom and the human spirit in terms of flourishing, in terms of finding God in everyday life and ordinary things? And I think John Paul II's message still applies very strongly. If you go back and if you read not only Centesimus Annus and some of the other great encyclicals like Veritas Splendor, but even his message to the church in Europe after the Synod, there are a lot of very timely reminders about what God has made us for. He made us free to be able to love and choose the truth. And, you know, the question that Pilate asked to Christ about what is truth still remains a very big one in today's world, even though it's, you know, more than 2,000 years after Pilate asked that question. And I think John Paul II provided an answer. You know, he looked to Christ for everything. And if we look to Christ to guide us, we might not find the perfect, let's say, political and economic solutions, but we'll have some kind of a lodestar for moral and spiritual guidance that if we make the effort to become good professionals and understand economics and politics and society better, you know, perhaps we can help create a more just and peaceful world. But at the same time, John Paul II knew, like all Christians should know, that our home is not finally here, that all of this is just a very short preparation for hopefully eternal union with God and for eternal life.